You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
This deal alone, even if fully implemented, will not end the deep divisions and mistrust between our two countries. We have a difficult history between us. If, in fact, Prime Minister Netanyahu is looking for the most effective way to ensure Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon, this is the best option.
After running 2 days over deadline, talks between Iran and the rest of the world in Lausanne have resulted in better news than many were anticipating, or, depending on one's perspective, worse tidings than some feared. Roger Boyce and Mary Dajewski will be joining me to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including yesterday's Al-Shabaab attack on a Kenyan university. How does Kenya rebuild its security and its reputation? Moscow's complaints about alleged American-organized Russophobia. Do they have a case? Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's attempt to get everyone to join him in blaming America for everything, and Argentine President Cristina Kirchner's plan to declassify Falklands war files. What is she up to? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, columnist for the Independent newspaper here in London, and Roger Boyce, diplomatic editor at The Times. Welcome both back to the show. And we shall start with Tehran, the streets of which are currently slightly more crammed than usual, with a somewhat greater than workaday clamour of car horns, as locals celebrate what appears to be the beginning of the end of Iran's long versus the world standoff vis-a-vis its nuclear program. A final settlement is still due to be signed on June 30th, which on past form is plenty of time for any number of things to go wrong, awry, or indeed askew. Mary, I'll ask you first. The people in Tehran cheering, and the reaction has been really quite extraordinary. No more so, I guess, even the President of the United States being broadcast live on Iranian state television, which is proper through the looking glass stuff. Are these people cheering, you know, at the thought that their country has put one over on the great Satan, or are they sensing, as I'd rather suspect is the case, a possibility of actually being reintroduced to the world?
No, I agree with you, and I think that what appears to be the popular response in Iran is one of the most encouraging things about this agreement, because when you look at it in the cold, hard light of day, you say, well, there's a very long way to go from here to a final agreement with all the dots and commas and everything agreed. A lot can happen between now and then. But the idea that the popular response in Iran has been so positive, I think that gives it a degree of credibility which it probably wouldn't have had. It also maybe puts the clerical leaders of Iran, maybe weakens their position slightly, because it was seen that they were possibly going to be a hindrance to this agreement.
It does, I guess, place them under a certain measure of pressure from a young and impatient population to sort Iran's relations with the rest of the world out. Roger, is it unalloyed good news, this agreement?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's got lots of loopholes and flaws, and that they're going to become very apparent over the next 3 months. I think that it's left a lot of enrichment capacity there intact. There are a lot of ways that they can get around it. There's a lot of ways, a la North Korea in the 1994 up till about 2003, how they managed to wriggle out of a nuclear agreement. Frankly, I'm worried that we're going to be completely duped.
Mary, do you think that's a significant concern? Because the thing is, I have thought this a lot during this entire process, and I'm perfectly happy to hold my hand up at this point. I'm pretty sure I said out loud at some point last week that this is clearly going nowhere, etc., etc. I was as surprised as anybody by the fact that they came up with anything at all. But there is always this suspicion, which I guess still persists, that Iran has been now for more than 12 years just running out the clock, trying to get to a point where they are unbombable, as it were, because they have a nuclear weapon to hand or are very close to one.
Yes, I mean, all that is true. But the idea that Iran has actually appeared and reappeared at the conference table time and again when it didn't actually have to, it could have turned around and said, no, you're treating us, you know, the international community, quote, you are treating us differently from other people who are trying to develop, as they see it, nuclear power rather than nuclear weapons. And they believe that they were hard done by. But at the same time, you can see that for the Iranian public, there was a view, a widespread view outside Iran, that the reason for wanting to pursue possibly nuclear weapons ambitions was a point of national pride. Now, if you've got the people out on the streets hailing this agreement, then it suggests that there is actually a way through.
Roger, President Rouhani of Iran, with all due recognition that he's not actually the guy who makes the final decisions, but he's been quoted in the last few minutes as saying that this is the start of a new relationship to the world. I can see that, yes, that's the kind of thing he would say. But is it possible that Iran have realized that we have a choice between being a nuclear-armed pariah state or a non-nuclear-armed full participant in global affairs and decided that on balance they'd rather be the latter?
Well, what they might have decided is that their breakout period could be postponed. This agreement, or the draft agreement, runs for most of the aspects of it for 10 years. Well, it might be that the Supreme Leader has kind of sort of said, well, that, I mean, not that he's going to be around in 10 years' time, but he's probably decided that you don't have to push for breakout, that's to say for nuclear weaponization, that fast. It's enough that the region, who you want to influence, all of your neighbors, have the sense that that you are on the brink of it. And being on the brink of it is just as effective for destabilizing or controlling those areas of the region that have Shia minorities or majorities. So I think that's kind of the consideration, that you don't actually physically need, you're not going to use this nuclear bomb anyway when it comes. It's just the sense that you're acknowledged by the world's greatest power to be capable of nuclearizing and actually using that weapon at some stage. The fear of America, the fears entertained by America that this might happen, may be enough to induce people to do your will within the region. And I think that's really the position we're in at the moment. And as for, well, first of all, I don't believe in an Iranian regime that's sensitive to public pressure at the moment. I just don't believe that. And second, I do think that the priority, and that's the reason why they have come back to the negotiating table all the time, is to get rid of sanctions. And probably Rouhani's mission is to have sanctions lifted, come what may. After all, he basically cheated the West in 2003 when he was the head of the nuclear negotiating team. There's no reason to think that his basic mentality hasn't changed, that they're duping us in order to have sanctions lifted. And then I think that will be mission accomplished for Rouhani. I think then all sorts of different power struggles then erupt. And that to me is the danger time, and it's also an extremely interesting time, of course.
Just staying on that thought, Roger, is it possible, though, that in the last few years in particular, the Iranians may have realised that they don't need a nuclear weapon as much as they might have thought they did? As has been pointed out by a few conservative sceptics in the last few weeks, they now control to some or other extent four Arab capitals, Beirut, Damascus, Sana'a and Baghdad, which is not something they could really have dreamt of a decade or so ago when this process started.
Yes, I was trying to explain. I think it's just the potential to have a nuclear weapon that gives you the clout. I don't think you actually have to rush towards one. And I think that's what they're playing with at the moment. As for these capitals, I'm not really sure that they're quite as much in control as they say they are. I mean, they're propping up Assad. And yes, they're giving some money to the rebels in Yemen. And yes, Shia militias are making trouble in Iraq, and they're on our side at the moment. So yes, there are things happening, but to say that they control Iraq, for example, I don't think that's quite right. I think that's megalomaniac thinking on the part of some people in Iran. I don't think that's quite. But it could yet happen, and that's really what I want to. That's my thought process. I think that the idea that you're on the brink of being a nuclear power makes these things happen, and you don't actually have to realize that. You can have in as many inspectors as you want, but you can be basically, as long as it's intact, as long as those enrichment facilities are intact, as long as there's the sense that you might have some kind of secret program tucked away somewhere, you can inspire enough respect in the region.
Okay, well, let's move along now to Kenya, which is today counting the cost of yesterday's attack by Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab on Garissa University in the country's northeast. 147 people are now confirmed dead. That's more than twice the toll of Al-Shabaab's 2013 assault on the Westgate Mall in Nairobi. Northeastern Kenya is now under dusk to dawn curfew. Mary, is it possible to see at this point what possible options Kenya has in terms of a response which will, one, obviously satisfy considerable and understandable public anger and ideally stop this sort of thing from happening again?
I think they've got so few options, really, and the risk is that the government is going to opt for absolutely the worst, which will be an almighty crackdown on everything and anything, strengthening anti-terrorism laws, which they don't have the actual, either the force or the intelligence to enforce, and the whole thing will actually be just as bad as it looks at the moment. I mean, it's, in some ways, it's so hard to believe what's just happened that apparently four members of Al-Shabaab managed to invade, invade a university campus and shot people dead in their dormitories to the tune of 150 students, and that they had time before any security forces of any variety came on the scene. They had time not just to shoot people indiscriminately, but to separate out the Muslims, most of whom they spared, from the Christians whom they shot. And that brings what was hitherto really what appeared a secondary aspect, the religion wars, that brings that right to the surface and threatens internal discord even worse than is currently going on.
Roger, the attack happened a day after President Uhuru Kenyatta gave a speech urging Kenyans overseas to tell people that the country was safe to visit after UK, Australia, others upgraded their security alerts. He did make the reasonable point that nobody issued travel advisories about Paris after the Charlie Hebdo massacre. That rather increases the pressure on him still further, doesn't it? That somewhat unfortunate timing.
Well, it's yes, although I don't think it was necessarily a factor in Al-Shabaab's calculations. These things require a bit of planning.
Indeed,
I see it, yes. Of course, if you compare the role of Boko Haram in Nigeria and its targeting of Christians there, which is partly a battle not just of religion but of territory and of power, power over minds, and an attempt perhaps to separate the north from the south. The attacks in Kenya do seem to be, Kenya is much more tourist orientated than Nigeria, so they do seem to be using what used to be called a strategy of tension, that's to say, trying to get the Kenyan government to overreact in a way that then scares off tourism and leads then to a vicious cycle of the economy then basically dropping down a hole. Someone quite clever as well as sinister and ruthless is planning these attacks. It's not just some kind of random massacre or even a kind of crazy escalation of what's happened before. I think there's something very sinister and very sophisticated going on. And in the old days, we would say, "Oh, it's Al Qaeda." Now we have to think again about that. But it's very complex.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Millett. Still with me are Mary Dijewski and Roger Boys, who will both still be here when we come back. Up next, we will have Russian outrage at the United States, Venezuelan outrage at the United States, and Argentine outrage at the United Kingdom, because some things never change.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse, and eminently digestible world of food, drink, and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs, and trade secrets with our Asia editor at large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month, a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
From a 71-year-old barber to a century-old cafe owner, Monocle Films visits Japan's sprightly elderly who are showing little sign of letting up.
For many in this long-living country, the official retirement age is merely a number. Up and down the country, many people in Japan are working well into their 70s and 80s, and sometimes even beyond. 100-year-old Ichiro Sekiguchi says that working has kept him fit. Today, he is still in charge at Café de l'Ombre, the coffee house he opened in Ginza in 1948.
Older, wiser, and going strong. Senior style in Japan, premiering now in the film section on Monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Roger Boys, diplomatic editor for The Times, and Mary Dejewski from The Independent. Russia's foreign ministry today fired off a philippic rambunctious, even by its own lofty standards, spluttering that propagandists working on Washington's orders were promoting an image of Russia as an aggressive, belligerent menace, almost as if Russia were the sort of country that would ever even consider seizing the territory of its neighbors, waging proxy wars, and lending high-tech anti-aircraft kit to semi-trained hillbillies who then shoot down civilian airlines. Mary, they called it a frenzied anti-Russian campaign. Frenzied was the exact word they used. Is there any evidence whatsoever for this suggestion?
Well, it's been said around the Ukraine crisis that this is actually as much a war of propaganda as it is a war on the ground. And it just seems that Russia has opened a new front because the West, that includes the Americans, the British, the French, everybody has been complaining for months that Russia has been running a ferocious propaganda war in support of their view of what's going on in Ukraine. Now it seems that they have a bit of a nerve calling pots and kettles black in blaming the Americans for doing something likewise. I think there is an extent to which a prevailing view in the West, and that includes America and the UK, that there is a very dominant view of Russia and of what's been going on in Ukraine, which to my mind is vastly too simplistic and propagandistic on both sides. So I don't think Russia is completely wrong, but I'm surprised that it's taken them this long to respond in kind.
But why would, just staying with you, Mary, why would the foreign ministry make this kind of complaint? I mean, they just sound kind of whiny. I mean, it's impossible to imagine that the US Department of State would issue a sort of actual, you know, communique saying, "Why are people who don't like us are calling us names?"
No, but the way that Russia's propaganda machine has been attacked in the West over more than a year now, as if its external radio and television services are purely propaganda arms of the state. And I would argue that it's much more complicated than that. They are presenting a view which is dominant in Russia. It's not simply propaganda. That Russia finally feels a bit hard done by this and is saying, well, look what you're doing.
Roger, do the Russians have a case here? Are we being beset by what they've described as Russophobic lampoons?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think what's happening is that there's some following this war, or in parallel with this war, or helping to fuel this war, there's been a massive expansion of bureaucratic resources in Moscow for what they call an information war. And you've seen that with Russia today. Its resources have doubled, trebled. They've tried to set up here. And they're looking for reasons and ways of justifying that money. It's like, I don't know, it's like our Minister of Defence, I suppose. You constantly create situations which justify hiring ever more people, especially your cousins and stuff, and getting them on the airwaves. And really, that's all that's happening, I think. I agree with Mary that one shouldn't underestimate how close the Russian so-called propaganda line is to actually what people really feel. And it's not because they're being told porkies by the Russian propaganda machine, but they actually believe it. That's to say, there is a kind of a synergy, in a way, between what Russians really feel and what they're actually hearing. But I think information war, it's got no future, really. I mean, if you go to Estonia, to Narva, where the Russians are, for example, the Russian minority is, they're bombarded with Russian propaganda like this. But if you ask them, would you rather live in Russia, they say, hell no, you know.
I was in Narva late last year and asked many of the citizens exactly that question and got precisely that response.
Yeah. Well, hell no.
Yeah.
I think in a way, if you wanted to find any sort of bright spot here, it might be that Russia is actually engaging in this argument almost for the first time. Because in the past, you really wouldn't have thought that Russia was terribly bothered about its image abroad. It does what it does, and really the rest of us can think what we want to think, and it hasn't seemed to be too concerned about it. The fact that it's making what appears to be quite a high-level protest suggests that somehow it's the information that's getting to them rather than almost anything else. And so, as I say, if you want to look on the bright side, maybe they are starting to get worried about their image. And if they're starting to get worried about their image, then maybe we'll see some sort of change.
Well, on a not unrelated note, Venezuela's increasingly strange president, Nicolas Maduro, is attempting to persuade 10 million of his country's citizens to sign a petition avowing their displeasure with the United States, specifically President Barack Obama's recent imposition of further sanctions on the country. This is a tall order. There are only 30 million people in Venezuela, and judging by recent polls, most of them like Maduro even less than they do Obama. Roger, is this as bonkers as it sounds?
Yeah, I think it is, but I kind of admire it. They even have a Ministry of Supreme Happiness, which I think is just fantastic, and we should have one.
As opposed to being just the creepiest thing you've ever heard.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think any country going through austerity should have a Ministry of Supreme Happiness. Yes, of course. I mean, it does, for those of us who lived through the British trade union movement at its peak, and especially in the newspaper business where people signed on massively to pretend that they'd been working, you know, printers and things. That's what's happening in Venezuela at the moment. I think there are multiple signatures, and of course it's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. And of course won't change anything, which, I mean, it's a way of deflecting, I suppose, a rather an increasingly unhappy population since the oil price drop and everything else. Things are just going from bad to worse. Deflecting them and just trying to crystallize anger around the United States rather than the Maduro government.
Well, Maduro is claiming 6.2 million signatures already, against which there have been many reports of school children and soldiers being made to sign it and government employees being fired for refusing to. Mary, is there any reason at all to imagine that President Barack Obama, when presented with this petition of 10 million angry Venezuelans, will respond in any way other than with a shrug and whatever?
No, except I imagine that he might be quite flattered in a way, because I'm not sure that he's got a particularly high profile. A lot of the complaints about President Obama and his foreign policy have been that America seems to be sort of retreating into itself and hasn't been projecting its power sufficiently around the world. And that might include among, at the top of the list practically, some of the nearest neighbours, like Latin America. So I would think that he might actually, as well as sparing himself a smile, he might actually say, well, there you see, profile's not so low after all.
See, this is why I think it would have been much, much funnier if Obama had just issued a statement or made a speech in praise of Nicolas Maduro, embracing him as a great friend of the North American people. Mm. Because being America's enemy, and final thought on this, Roger, it's really Maduro's only selling point at this stage, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, I do feel that Obama went a little bit too far, probably, in his sanctions policy towards Venezuela. The best policy, really, is to ignore Maduro entirely until he collapses.
Well, persisting finally with the subject of temperamental Latin American populists venting historical grievance, President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner has announced plans to declassify secret documents dating from the 1982 war for the Falkland Islands. Mary, is there much likelihood these will tell us anything we didn't already know?
I don't know what they're likely to say, but I would not rule out the fact that there are people working overtime in the archives of British intelligence and the Ministry of Defence this holiday weekend, hoping against hope that they're not going to unearth something that's going to be hugely embarrassing to the British. We know, for instance, there's an interesting juxtaposition here that I think it was reported today that one of the things Ed Snowden has been saying from his fastness in Moscow is that the British were spying on Argentina way beyond the end of the Falklands War and pretty much up until at least 2011,
Wouldn't it have been up to today? It would have been more surprising if they weren't, wouldn't it?
Well, it would, but you don't like these things to come out. So the fact that it's come out rather than just being left at speculative level, it's not particularly welcome, I would imagine, to the British side. And I would imagine that Cristina Kirchner is looking for some sort of embarrassment at a time when the British have suddenly said, for reasons best known to themselves, that they're going to beef up security from the British side in around the Falklands.
Well, that announcement may not have nothing to do with the fact that of fairly recent, within the last few days, discoveries of oil and gas around the Falklands by British firms. Is that also where President Kirchner may be going with this, Roger?
Yes, it's possible. I mean, well, my own view on Argentina is it's never been the same since Jeremy Clarkson visited it, to be honest, brought it to its final knees. But yes, it could be. To be honest, I see this more as an internal affair. If you want to mount a purge of the Army General Staff, this is the way to do it, because there's an awful lot of the older generation of Argentinian generals who may have messed up in quite serious ways. And if you want to engineer some kind of change in that sense, then don't forget we're dealing with a pretty paranoid president here. This is one way to do it. I don't really necessarily read it as a response to the British, although, of course, responding to the British is part of her great narrative. I think there's something else going on in internal Argentine politics.
Just a final thought on this, Mary. Why do you think Argentina will not let this go? The Clarkson affair to which Roger referred was the most recent and somewhat absurd, really, manifestation of it.
Well, I think that the Argentines feel that they have a genuine grievance. And all you have to do is look at the geography of this dispute to realise that from the British side, at least from my perspective, this is not a sensible territory for the British to want to hold on to. Well, I understand
Is Hawaii not a sensible territory for the Americans to want to keep?
I understand that it was once Argentina had invaded the Falklands, then the British had to respond. And in a way, that's landed us with this territory, probably for another century or so. But looking at it logistically and simply geographically, it does not make sense. And if I were Argentina, I would really be extremely resentful. I mean, it's off Argentina's coast. It's not off the British coast.
We will have to leave it there. Mary Dujeski of The Independent, Roger Boys of The Times, thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Stefano Fumagalli and Sara Monetta. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Monocle's international playlist is with you for the next half an hour. Then at 1900 hours, Marcus Hippie is here for the menu. At 2200 hours, Emma Nelson and Peter Card will present the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, also with me, Andrew Muller. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening and happy Easter.